Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense. We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies. Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, infographics, relevant links, book suggestions, or just to leave comments. Follow us on Twitter at @SchoolSucksShow. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
So we thought we'd come to pay you a visit, talk with some of the students here in Des Moines and your parents, because I know that there's nothing that high schoolers love more than being in public with their moms and dads. I know that. That's what Malia and Sasha tell me all the time. Nobody in a 21st century economy is going to be able to do what they want to do with their lives unless they've got a great education. That's just the truth. By 2020, 2 in 3 job openings are going to require some form of post-high school education, whether it's a 4-year university or a community college or a tech school, and it's an investment that pays off. Just as higher education's never been more important, let's face it, it's also never been more expensive. And that's why Arnie and I have been working to try to make college and post-high school education more affordable. We've increased scholarships. We reformed our student loan system that funneled billions of taxpayer dollars into big banks. We said, let's cut out the middleman. Let's put that money directly to students. We created a new tax credit of up to $2,500 to help working families pay for tuition and books and fees. We're helping people cap their federal student loan payments at 10% of their income. So if you want to be a teacher, or you want to be a social worker, or some other profession that may not make a huge amount of money, you can still do that knowing that you're not going to go, you're still going to be able to afford to support yourself and your family while doing it. And we're fighting for 2 years of free community college for any student that's willing to work for it. We're also simplifying the financial aid process. To give you more time as you make a decision. Right now, about 2 million students don't claim the financial aid that they're eligible for. And part of it is it's just complicated and time-consuming. And so those young people are leaving money on the table. And there may be some young people here who are not aware of all the financial help you can get. So what we've done is we've shortened the federal student aid form, it's called FAFSA, down to about 20 minutes. It used to be about 2-3 times as long. And because only Congress has the power to eliminate certain requirements, we're asking them to simplify it even further. The good news is it's got some good bipartisan support. That's not just good for the students, by the way. That's also good for America. Because this country was built on the notion that it doesn't matter where you come from, what you look like, what your last name is, if you're willing to work hard, you can make it. And education is the key to making that future possible. That's how we grow this country. That's how we make it successful. And that's the incredible project, the great experiment in democracy that all of you are part of.
Hey, everybody. This is Brett. Today is Monday, September 28th, 2015, and we opened with a clip of Barack Obama. And if you're listening to this in the distant future, Barack Obama was the last president before Trump. And, I guess if you're listening to this in the distant future, this show doesn't really matter that much because you're already probably right in the middle of dealing with the fallout of the crisis we're trying to warn you about in today's show. So if you're listening in 2015, hey, perfect timing. Anyway, in this clip, Obama is talking to a group of high school seniors earlier this year in Des Moines, Iowa. And in that speech, he had a great line. Did you catch it?
Nobody in a 21st century economy is going to be able to do what they want to do with their lives unless they've got a great education.
Agree. But a big part of our mission here at School Sucks Project is making sure young people know what the word education means. What does Barack Obama think it means?
By 2020, 2 in 3 job openings are going to require some form of post-high school education. Whether it's a 4-year university or a community college or a tech school, and it's an investment that pays off.
That sounds really familiar because it's almost the exact same thing that my classmates and I were told 20 years ago when we were all seniors in high school. And we now continue with another clip of financial analyst and CEO of Euro-Pacific Capital, Peter Schiff, interviewing college graduates, so essentially high school seniors, 4 or 6 years later in their lives. And he's conducting these interviews in the middle of a very lively Bourbon Street bar scene in New Orleans, Louisiana. And by the way, this video is very visual. So what you're going to hear in the podcast is people talking about their college experience, the missing visual information that I'll fill in for you. Almost all of the people that he interviews are bartenders or doormen or bouncers or this other one that has really kind of baffled me, its appearance over the last 5 years or so. Human sign holders. All right, here's his video. I've shortened it to save you some time, but you will definitely get the point.
Hey, it's Peter Schiff at SchiffRadio.com. I'm here in New Orleans on the famous Bourbon Street. And I want to ask some of the people who are working here tonight exactly where they went to college or if they went to college, what they majored in, when they graduated. Let's find out just what kind of career a college education buys you in America. Come along. Are you working here tonight?
Yes, I am. I'm from California. How are you doing?
Good. By any chance, did you go to college out there?
Virginia State University. I'm a Trojan, went for physical education, and I'm a lingerie football player.
Did you go to college?
Yeah.
When did you graduate?
2006.
What was your major?
History and English.
And now you're driving a bike?
Yep.
What was your major?
It was robotics.
When did you graduate?
I graduated in 2003.
And what are you doing now?
I'm working for a strip club.
Did you happen to go to college?
Yeah.
What did you major in?
Business.
Communications.
Radiology.
Graphic design. Business management.
Psychology.
Science.
Did you go to college?
Yes.
And what did you major in?
Business administration.
General studies.
Economics.
What's your major?
Business.
Criminal justice.
Culinary.
Asian studies.
Did you go to college?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, what did you major in?
Political science.
By any chance, did you go to college?
Yeah, I did. Went to Tulane.
What did you major in?
Business.
Business.
What was your major?
Business and marketing.
This is why you should not major in liberal arts.
I'm a bouncer here.
Yeah. What did you major in?
Art.
Is this just a part-time job, or is driving a bike what you do for a living now?
It's a full-time job. It's what I do for a living.
When did you graduate?
About 20 years ago.
4 years ago.
It's been about 12 years.
About a year. 2 years ago.
Do you have any student loans?
Yeah, $90,000 worth.
How much do you owe, if you don't mind my asking?
I do mind you asking.
Do you have any student loans?
About $25,000. I've lucked out. I owe about $7,000.
I'm like $20,000 in the hole.
Do you have any student loans you're still trying to pay off?
Yeah, about $25,000 worth. I just don't pay them.
Like $25,000. Yeah.
That's a lot of peddling.
I still got loans to pay off, man.
You still got?
I still have loans, yeah.
And what are you doing now?
I'm working security here at Ritz Cabaret.
You know what my uncle always said?
What?
It's like, hey, is there anybody here with a college degree? Get me another beer.
All right, so the stage is set for my discussion with Mike Vine. Mike is the editor for Schiff Gold News. And I recently ventured out to beautiful Portsmouth, New Hampshire, to meet Mike in his office and discuss the coming, if not already upon us, student loan debt crisis. Stick around after the discussion for a few closing thoughts from me. Thanks for listening, everybody. Here we go.
Early in the morning, factory workers.
my guest on School Sucks today is Mike Vine. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm doing well. Well, I'm excited. I'm in a new place. That's always exciting. Where are we right now?
You are in the Praxium in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. This is our mixed-use, flexible-use, Liberty meeting space here in Portsmouth. And we do all sorts of things from homeschool classes to hangouts to crafting meetups to actually a couple of companies are based here, including my own, where we co-work and do all sorts of computery things.
And you're the principal of Sentinel Consulting. It's a marketing firm.
That's right. We have the good fortune of being a liberty-oriented marketing firm.
Absolutely. And you're also the editor for Peter Schiff's Gold News.
Correct.
And how long have you been doing that?
Peter Schiff's Gold News launched about a year ago. I've been working with Schiff Gold, which is his gold company, for since the beginning, 2010, and with Euro Pacific Capital, his brokerage firm as well.
Awesome. And I wanted to actually start today with a little discussion. We're going to be talking about this student loan debt. Are we calling it a crisis yet?
I think it's a crisis.
It's time for the word crisis.
No one knows it's a crisis, but it's a crisis, yeah.
Yeah, so you sent me a video along with this white paper that we're going to talk about on the subject, and it was called, Is a College Degree Worth the Cost You Decide? So it was a video that Peter made, and very confronting, I think, for a lot of people in the audience, but also for a lot of the people involved. Around, I'm actually going to put it at the beginning of the show, but people will know by now that he goes around Bourbon Street in New Orleans and talks to people who seem to work primarily in bars and yep. strip clubs
yep.
about how much college education they have. And they have, I think, what a lot of people would find to be a pretty surprising amount.
These people have BAs. Some of them have master's degrees. They're well-educated folks that are ultimately working as bouncers or bartenders, which I think a lot of us would consider not necessarily something that you need a liberal arts education to do.
You know, and I was thinking too, like if Peter Schiff had brought the video to me and said, Brett, what do you think of my video? I might have said, well, okay, so we're in New Orleans, right? And I'm just trying to get the whole picture. And I'm asking myself, is this an accurate representation of the nation as a whole? Is this a fair sample? I'm thinking New Orleans. That's not a place where people go to not party, you know?
That's right.
So it's obviously not a national sample, but it is alarming what you see.
There are national samples.
Yeah.
I don't have the precise percentage, but right now there is a record number of graduates, people with BAs working menial jobs. That number is going up year after year. So this isn't just a question of him being on Bourbon Street. That was a convenient place for him to shoot the video and
scenic.
Yep. And it sets the right tone and atmosphere. But no, this is representative of something that's going on across the U.S., a significant problem. And, you know, something I can personally attest to. I did happen to go to school in New Orleans, but, you know, I saw many friends graduate and end up working in bars in the industry. And so I can say at least that this wasn't just a matter of cherry picking the best answers.
The reason why I bring that up, though, is it reminds me of something that I like to incorporate into the show wherever possible. And it's the idea of personal responsibility, you know, and a lot of personal responsibility starts with information. And so I'm seeing the video and I'm thinking, well, this is a setting that promotes or maybe even rewards certain lifestyle choices,
right.
You know, and there's even kind of a support system there for when those lifestyle choices don't produce success.
Right.
And I know that might sound like a judgmental thing to say, especially my audience knows that I'm speaking as somebody who's made a lot of poor choices, lifestyle and financial. So I'm not trying to be.
We've all made tough choices.
Yeah. There is a place for personal responsibility in this. It's not a problem that's entirely grown out of uncollateralized federal loan practices.
Sure. You do have a situation like with military recruitment where you're taking people who are very young, who maybe haven't had a chance to really develop that ethic of personal responsibility and offering them what seems like easy street. We'll pay for everything. You don't have to worry about your real life for another 4 years after high school graduation.
Yeah.
That's a tough offer for a lot of people to turn down. And I think it's hard for people at 17 or 18 when they're accepting these federal student loans to conceptualize what it's going to be like to be 25 and stuck in a job you don't like, turning down entrepreneurial opportunities because you got to make those payments every month.
Yeah, I remember being like 23 or 24 and looking for jobs in my field. I went to school for communications.
Mm-hmm. Apropos.
Yeah. Going and sitting down across the table from somebody for a job in television or radio, and they would ask questions like, okay, so how many years experience do you have? What does your portfolio look like? And, you know, me kind of being like, oh, you must be new at this. I went to college. Yeah. So just show me to my desk.
Right.
And it's not like that at all. I mean, I worked briefly in the field that I majored in 2001. But then, I think for a lot of reasons, following personal interest, my career went towards more, the educational direction.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of that too was this really frustrating experience from, you know, 21, 22, not knowing that I actually needed to have experience to get the kind of jobs that I was told about while I was in school. And I did feel like I had been kind of
conned. Yeah.
Exactly. So when I talk about personal responsibility, I think it's more for, I mean, a lot of these people, 35, 40 years old, that are being interviewed. So it just came to mind, and I like to inject it into the discussions where I can, and it'll probably come back around to that. But let's talk about this student loan bubble. The title of the paper is The Student Loan Bubble, Gambling with America's Future. And it's written by Addison Quayle.
Yes, Quayle is an interestingly pronounced last name. He's a colleague of mine. He's one of the precious metal specialists at Schiff Gold. So Schiff Gold, you know, without being overly promotional here, Schiff Gold is a company that's actually staffed by people who read into these issues. A lot of Ron Paul guys, Austrian school economists. So he actually went and did the research and produced this report, and they put it out.
Right. I like how he builds momentum in the beginning by talking about this is not a new phenomenon with a student loan bubble. We have, you know, the .com
right
explosion of the
housing.
Housing, which pretty much erupted, 2008?
Yep.
And now we have this one.
Right.
For those in my audience who are newer to economics, can we just briefly discuss the background of the first two bubbles? Like, how do those things happen? What are the intentions of suppressing interest rates? What outcomes are people who want to do that envisioning somewhere down the road in the future?
Right.
So you can pick the .com or the mortgage crisis.
So I come at these issues from a perspective widely known as the Austrian School of Economics, which is a very free market. And examines, which many other economists don't, examines how government interventions distort the economy. And anytime the government intervenes with the economy, there's going to be a distortion that's created. It's just a question of who's going to end up paying for that and how big is the distortion. So each of these bubbles, we're now in a situation where we're going from bubble to bubble to bubble,
mm-hmm.
because we have a Federal Reserve is the central bank prints new money. That money then has to find a place, and it ends up bidding up assets. So it prints new money. Usually that goes to wealthy, politically connected folks. And then whatever they're buying, the prices skyrocket. This also sends a signal to entrepreneurs and other investors saying, oh, well, maybe there's something promising going on here. I'm also going to invest. And so you get a Ponzi scheme situation going. And you see this in any economy that has central banking. The difference is the U.S. economy has less and less real economy underneath to stabilize everything. So we're now in an economy where Americans are producing less and less under the burdens of taxes and regulations. And the thing that we have now is bubbles. And so we just go from bubble to bubble to bubble. Each time a bubble bursts, there's no one in Washington and certainly in the general public that really understands why that happened in the first place. So they're happy to go back to the solution, quote unquote, that caused the bubble in the first place. Let's print more money. Let's do more stimulus. Let's hike regulations on banks and enterprises. And then we end up with the next bubble. So if you take, you know, .coms, a lot of fresh, cheap money chasing an asset that everyone got excited about. It was a mania. That burst. Then assets were chasing housing. And in each one of these, there's generally not a recent precedent of a burst. So people don't really realize at the time that things are getting out of control. we can see it in retrospect. You know, in the mid-2000s, you started seeing all these house flipping shows.
Yeah.
And everyone's just all of a sudden, everyone has to, everyone's flipping. We're buying, you can't lose. As long as I go in and put up some new sheetrock, I'm going to make double my money on a house. Well, that's not how economies actually work. There really isn't easy money in the world.
Right.
So anytime you start seeing everyone making this seemingly impossible easy money, whether it's, you know, I'm three college students and we form a .com and someone's offering us, you know, $50 million to house flipping. And now, you know, these colleges are out of control. You look at universities and they're building massive fitness facilities. They're doing new dorms. They're offering, you know, various complicated, luxurious study abroad programs. And then there's also this whole sector of these for-profit colleges, like Capella and Strayer and DeVry, University of Phoenix, that really were unheard of, a decade ago. And they are now 70% of student loan delinquencies are people going to these types of schools. So these are the equivalent of subprime mortgages. When the housing bubble started to crater, it was the most far-fetched, the most financially ridiculous mortgages that these people were being offered, you know, 2% interest rate for the first few years to get them in the house, to give them that mortgage. But the banks knew, everyone knew that these people couldn't actually pay the full term of the mortgage. Mm-hmm. The interest rate would reset and these people just couldn't afford it. They could only afford to make that, barely make that payment for the teaser rate in the beginning. Well, now we have colleges that are the equivalent. They are giving degrees to students. The students don't have the capacity to earn what's necessary to pay back all the loans that they're taking out.
Yeah, so the bar is too low. The barrier to entry, in other words, is
typically
too
markets
low.
will regulate themselves.
Yeah.
If people have to pay for the consequences of their decisions.
Right.
So if I'm a bank and I'm offering a student loan, a student better come to me and say, "I have straight A's. Here's why I think I'm going to get into med school. And based on med school, here's why I think I'm going to be able to actually pay off this loan." The federal government doesn't do any of that. It's the constant mandate is we want to expand access.
Yeah.
Well, that just means basically giving money to people that private banks have decided are not likely to be able to repay it.
So let's qualify the student loan issue as a bubble and perhaps a crisis.
Sure.
Using some numbers. So I think 10 years ago, maybe a little less than 10 years ago, we're talking like total student loan debt in the nation is around $400 billion.
Right.
And what is it today?
$1.2 trillion.
Okay.
In 10
so that's
years.
300% income. Okay. Yeah. That's
right.
Significant.
And the current forecasts are in another 10 years, we're going to hit $3.3 trillion.
Okay.
That's a substantial share of the U.S. economy.
There also appears to be an escalation, which Obama might get blamed for. There's been a 75% increase in total outstanding student loan debt since the beginning of his administration.
That's right. And I can't point to a specific, really all of these programs escalate over time. So, you know, we can blame Bush, we can blame Obama.
Yeah, sure.
But the tendency is when these programs aren't working out, the government will double down on them. They expand them, and they say, "Well, if only we have more funding, we can, fix the problem."
It's like the schools. Like when their behavior problems persist, it's like, "Oh, we must not be doing the bad things hard enough."
Yeah, correct.
Exactly. Okay, I gotcha. Let's talk about as we continue to explain this as a crisis, the default rate.
Sure. So right now, the default rate is around 11%, but the delinquency rate, which means effectively everyone who's not paying their student loans right now, is 27%. You have almost a third of all people with student loans are just not making payments at this point. They're not officially in default, all of them, but they're not paying. And the government is basically saying, okay, we're going to turn a blind eye. We don't want to classify these people as defaulted quite yet.
So are there no payments being made? So we're dealing with, like, let's just say 11% roughly total default.
Yeah.
And then we've got close to 15% that's either deferred or forbearance.
Maybe they're making small payments,
okay,
but they're vastly behind on their payments.
That's what I want to see, because I know that's becoming a bigger and bigger thing, you know, $5 a month, $10 a month just to get it out of default. So that's all taken in that. I've seen like numbers like 23 to 27% of all loans are in non-payment state, basically,
right,
or small payment state. So just to compare this to the housing crisis, there's collateral in that, right? Like, if bank decides or realizes that you're not paying, the bank has a house it can take.
That's right.
But in this case, there's nothing. So what does that mean? What is, how does that make this different?
A few more facts and figures. I don't want everyone's eyes to glaze over. But if the current delinquents all default, we're looking at a $250 billion hole in the economy, unpaid debts.
Yeah.
The subprime mortgages, the subprime mortgage bailout, the TARP bailout was $400 billion.
Yeah.
So we're looking at something that's similar in terms of magnitude. It's not as high. But then, as you said, with housing, when you default on your mortgage, the bank is left with a mortgage. When you default on your student loan, there's nothing. Well, actually, there really is you. You are the collateral. And one of the scary implications, I think, is they do not allow bankruptcy out of student loans. So if you're any other debt that you take out, you can always declare bankruptcy and work with your creditors. You don't have that option with student loans. So they will continue to garnish up to 15% of your wages for 25 years. So we can say that there's nothing backing it up, but really, you can look at it one of two ways. Either there's nothing backing it up, or there's the indentured servitude of an entire generation that's going to be working jobs, having their wages garnished to continue paying these loans.
Okay, so why do you know or have any theories about why student loans are outside of bankruptcy proceedings?
I think the notion, the logic behind it was that everyone would simply get student loans, declare bankruptcy when they graduated, and move on with their life.
And then in 7 years, so they've got a basically, what, a clean slate,
right,
credit-wise by the time they're 30.
Right.
Oh, that would be genius. Yeah, sure.
So there is some logic behind it, but again, it is peculiar. I mean, we have a legal principle that we don't believe in debt slavery in this country, in the Western world, yet this is a kind of form of indentured servitude that you have to continue to pay off these, that you have no recourse to bankruptcy, no matter how dire your financial situation.
Unless you're willing, I guess, to go completely off the grid.
Yeah. That's always an option.
Right. It's a difficult option for most, because most people don't go to college to go off the grid.
Right.
You know? They go to college to get a job and have some job security.
Well, there's a lot of people now in the economy that are doing that in a way. There's surely lots of people, I know of people, where they will not take jobs in the quote-unquote white market. They'll only be paid under the table, because as soon as they start having any W-2 income, then they're getting garnished. Their wages are getting garnished. So, yeah, you do have people that are basically pushed into these marginal roles. And similar to the economics of welfare, when you spend your whole career working under the table. I mean, there are great agorists, as they're called out. There's great people out there that, manage to build private businesses. But for most people, working under the table, you're never going to be able to climb that ladder,
right,
that gets you to what we would generally consider a successful career.
Yeah.
So you have all these people who are now facing this this kind of Sophie's choice of, do I continue making money under the table and be able to support myself, or do I start making, you know, a pittance, even less than minimum wage, because I'm 15% is being taken away. And the government does have some programs where they will, you know, quote unquote, work with you if you are of a certain wealth level. But, at the end of the day, that only contributes to the fact that this is a bubble, that these people are not going to be able to pay it. They're strongly disincentivized to even try at this point.
I agree. So let's take that further down the road. And I hear a lot of cries for student loan forgiveness.
Hmm.
What would you say are the economic implications of something like that?
Student loan forgiveness is teaching people they can have something for nothing. These loans are still issued by private banks, and the government essentially guarantees them. So as with any of these bubbles, you sort of have to decide who's going to take the brunt of the fallout. If the financial system were left with these loans, that would be catastrophic. It's unlikely. More likely, the federal government, which has guaranteed these loans, will make the banks whole. But then they have to add another $250 billion debt on top of all of the U.S. federal government itself is bankrupt and only pays its bills by issuing new debt at this point. So there's a sense that, well, you know, at the end of the day, the government can take care of it and has unlimited resources. That's absolutely not true. The only resources that the government has now are really based on the Chinese, some overseas buyers of U.S. treasury debt, and domestic buyers. The federal government is effectively on its own bankrupt.
Right, because it's not like they can count on the productivity of the people who actually live in the country anymore, especially like you go forward a generation or two when you have got such a higher percentage of people who are in this very situation. Mm. If anything doesn't change, I mean, I don't even know if you can project that far into the future. It might not last that long, but like even if you go 20 years in the future, you've had 20 college graduating classes thrown into the economy. And you have a lot of people in this situation. You have more than a 10 or 11% default rate right. at that point. And then there's also the question of, you know, when the United States borrows money from foreign countries, our productivity is the collateral, I would think, for a big part of that, you know, as taxpayers.
That's the belief, yeah. Foreign governments recently have found trouble collecting. So they've built up, the Chinese have built up $1.2 trillion in U.S. debt notes, IOUs. And their presumption is that they're either going to be able to resell them or they can trade them in for real assets. And with, populist candidates like Donald Trump basically trying to pass measures to block them from, you know, taking all these dollars that they've accumulated and just buying goods and services here, it's definitely putting them in a position where they're going to rethink continuing to fund U.S. debt. And if they stop funding it, there is no one else. That gets to beyond the student loan bubble to really the underlying issue with the U.S. economy and why this, if the student loan bubble existed in isolation and we were otherwise had a healthy economy, it wouldn't be as big a deal. But we do have essentially a fake economy that's funded by foreign debt. Mm-hmm. So either we can keep issuing that debt, or the other route that they have is printing new money. So say, let's just take the $250 billion. The government says, okay, well, we'll absorb that. The government doesn't have magic money. They do have a printing press. But when they print new money, that devalues all of the money that all of us use. So when we all go out and buy a hamburger, and a few, you know, 10 years ago, a hamburger was $6 or $7 and now it's $12. That is the effect of inflation. You add another $250 billion on top of the trillions of debt that the government's already accumulated. You're just making that, exacerbating that problem all the more and leading to a point where we're going to have potentially runaway inflation.
So, right. So we're pushing, or not we, they are pushing 20 trillion now. It's like 18, 19.
I think it's, might be 15. But yeah, so the debt to GDP ratio right now is over 100%.
Okay. And can you explain the significance of that? Because I hear that thrown around a lot, debt to GDP ratio. And I know that like even 10 years ago, you have a dramatically different number as far as percentage is concerned for debt to GDP ratio. It's in the paper. I think it was like around 60%. Mm-hmm. And for the last couple of years, it's been over 100. So I remember it was a big news event when that happened.
Right.
But can you just explain for my audience, again, for the people who might be newer to this, and to me, because I don't understand the significance of it fully, why such a high debt-to-GDP ratio is so alarming?
The short answer is governments can only accumulate debt to a certain point before they pass a point of no return.
Yeah.
Some people see it as 90% or 60%.
Right.
The figure I've seen most often is 90%, but there comes a point, just as with individuals, you can go out and take out credit cards, and then you can take out other credit cards and pay those credit cards off, and you can withdraw, you can do, you know, reverse mortgages and pull equity out of your home. Eventually, you're going to hit a point where you've accumulated so much debt that no one's going to lend to you anymore, and you have payments that you can't possibly make based on your income. So debt to GDP is one way to look at governments in those terms. And governments are not, as I said, they're not magic money creators. They can print more money. So it's different than you and I. When we hit that point where our creditors come after us, we're stuck. We have to declare bankruptcy or figure out a payment plan. The government does have the ability to essentially just go ahead and print a bunch of more IOUs and print more money and say, okay, well, here, I'm going to pay you off. But they've not created more value by doing that. When they do that, they're stealing from all of our pockets.
Yeah.
By devaluing the money in our pockets.
And as the Austrians, and of course, like Peter Schiff's been super vocal about this on every cable news station that will have him. Mm. This doesn't work forever. The other thing that we've seen really since the late 1960s, but I think there's also been an acceleration in this over the last couple decades, is entitlement programs. Mm. And not, I'm not talking Social Security or Medicare, we're talking welfare. If these checks can't be sent anymore, that's a very, very ugly scene.
Right. Well, the likelihood is not that people will stop getting their checks, but that the checks won't be worth anything. So if right. if you're guaranteed $400 a month from your pension, Social Security, right now, you know, in some cities that can buy you housing and keep food on the table. If inflation continues, you're guaranteed $400 a month. That's not going to change. Sometimes they're indexed to inflation, but at a very low rate. So you're going to continue to get your 400. Well, what happens if, you know, the price of rice doubles? Well, now, you know, or the price of just everything. What if the general price level doubles? Now you're 400, you're still getting $400, but you're only able to buy half as much in terms of goods and services.
So we've got the story, the famous story from Germany of the man who went to the bank, cashed his pension check that he had worked for his entire career, went across the street and bought a cup of coffee.
Right.
I don't know if it's true or not.
That is absolutely true. It's happened in country to country, not just Weimar Germany. Argentina has been through this. Venezuela is going through it right now.
Mm-hmm.
So you can actually go and log in the news and watch it in real time. The shelves are going bare. There's nothing to, even if there is something to buy, the money is losing value so quickly that you can't, by the time you get paid, you have to spend it all immediately. And then the next person tries to spend it and spend it and spend it. It's a scary situation. Typically, you look at what you call a developed industrial democratic society. Those situations are less likely to happen. Mm-hmm. Hyperinflations usually happen with war.
Yeah.
Or a state falling apart. But the U.S. is in a particularly vulnerable position because the U.S., for the first time in world history, the U.S. has a fiat, meaning there's no backing, fiat currency that is used around the world as the reserve currency. The U.S. dollar is accepted everywhere. It's considered by most people in the world as good as gold.
Yeah.
And for a long time, the U.S. currency, U.S. dollar was the most reliable currency that you could get. It held its value for our lifetimes. The inflation rate's been very low. It's been a safe bet. But what we're seeing is from student loans to housing to stocks to municipal bonds, all of that is falling apart. And the worst crises can often be in the situations where people just don't believe it could ever happen. And the U.S. is in that situation now. I can hearken back to Hurricane Katrina. I mentioned that I went to school in New Orleans. I got stuck in Hurricane Katrina. The thing was, on paper, everyone knew that potentially a hurricane could come along and dump Lake Pontchartrain into New Orleans.
Yeah.
And that was a possibility. But we had to evacuate every year when hurricanes came. It got to the point where no one really believed any given year would really be the year. And that's why so many people got stuck.
Yeah.
And the U.S. is in that situation where there's such confidence, there's such belief that the U.S. is the leader of the free world, even as we're sinking in all these freedom indexes year over year, even as these new bubbles are popping up, inflation rate is rising. There's just this belief that we're untouchable that could prime us for, I think, a really catastrophic outcome.
Absolutely. I wanted to move into a discussion about hedges, essentially, sure. What we can do, right? Now, if Peter Schiff said to buy gold, let's say, which he has said many times before, let's just play this out. This is interesting. Could I amass enough gold and silver?
Sure.
Where then hyperinflation hits,
mm-hmm.
and I still owe $40,000, right, in student loans.
Right, but you pay them back with one of your pieces of gold as opposed to all of them.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, there's an argument, and Peter has talked about the argument for taking out a low fixed rate mortgage right now. Because if inflation does take hold, once again, anything that's a fixed payment, if you're on the receiving end, it's bad for you. If your pension is a fixed payment of $400 a month, that's bad for you in inflation. But if you're the one paying, inflation is very good for you.
So I don't know if we're saying that that's advice, right? Can you defer until, because actually, you know, when hyperinflation hits, and I often wonder when we see, like you mentioned, these freedom indexes going down, when we see a lot of this police state apparatus being built up, is it in preparation for that kind of event? Because I'm thinking that when hyperinflation does happen, whatever I have left in student loan debt is not going to be in my top three concerns.
Yes.
You know, because it's not even going to matter anymore.
Right.
I owe that money to a government that's collapsing.
Right.
You know,
there's definitely a case to be made to defer debt.
Yeah.
The incentives, without that being personal financial advice, the incentive that is essentially the issue. The incentives that are being created by the government right now are telling people not to pay back their debts, not to be responsible, not to take jobs that will lead to future career growth, not to take risks in entrepreneurship and build new businesses. All the messages are the very things that will not allow the U.S. economy to grow into the future. And that's why we're seeing that it has stagnated.
Yeah.
At a certain point, the burden gets too strong, and the you know, Atlas can no longer hold the world.
Exactly.
And besides the fallout from the student loan debt itself, $250 billion on top of the national debt, it also creates a real political issue. You have a whole generation of young people who are saddled with all this debt. It feels unfair. They've been conned. And then you have a figure like Bernie Sanders that comes along, or someone even worse down the road, and he says, well, we'll forgive it. You won't have to worry about this. Those people have such a personal interest in getting that person elected, regardless of what the rest of their platform is. You know, Bernie Sanders is interesting for a Democratic candidate, is pro-war. He's not even good in civil liberties. But a lot of young people, it's totally become a class warfare situation where they'd say, well, I feel like I got the short end of the stick. I'm stuck in this dead end job. I did all the right things and the market didn't work for me. They don't see that the government intervention got them in this situation. So you're really creating a perfect recipe for someone really scary to come along.
Find the bad guys and punish them. Yeah.
Yeah. We're going to take care of this for you. You did get a raw deal. And the answer is to give me more power. And I'm worried about the political ramifications. You know, the U.S. is going through this economic trauma. We really need to have the most responsible people at the helm, people who aren't making these big promises, yet we're setting it up for people to really want to vote for those types of people.
And I think it's interesting to point out that I think Sanders and Trump are the front runners for each party.
Right.
So, geez, Mike, with $1.2 trillion in student loan debt, you think we'd be smarter, but...
Yeah.
that would
involve colleges teaching something.
Exactly. Let's just expand that hedge a little more. Let's talk specifically about gold and silver first as a way to protect one's personal wealth.
Sure.
And then there's a couple other suggestions that I would want to just mention briefly. Maybe talk a little bit about Bitcoin and, you know, questions about the stability of Bitcoin. And then expatriation, but I don't even know if that could, because we'd be talking about maybe the collapse of the world economy at that point.
That's a separate.
Yeah, let's come back to that.
Okay.
Let's start with gold and silver.
Okay. So the reason that I'm involved in Peter Schiff's gold news, that I really believe in Peter's message, is that gold and silver, precious metals, are the only asset that doesn't depend on counterparties, meaning you just hold it. There are other assets like oil, corn, but those have other issues. I mean, you're not going to be storing barrels of oil in your basement. Corn, you know, rots. They have value on the market. But gold and silver, the reason that they've historically been money, and they were money up until 1965.
Right.
The reason that those particular substances have been money is because they have the perfect characteristics of money. They're uniform. They're fungible, divisible. And they don't rot. Silver tarnishes, but you can wipe it off.
Mm-hmm.
Gold doesn't even do that. It sits there, and people want it. And people have wanted it throughout human history for various reasons. Silver tends to be a little bit more industrial, where people will actually use it in to build stuff. Gold is used somewhat, but more is jewelry. People like gold because it's shiny and yellow, really, and
useful.
It's useful. Its primary use is actually as money.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't depend on any issuing authority. There's no government backing it. It it has just been accepted around the world. People want gold and they use it as money. So when you're looking at a situation, when you have this, you know, these bubbles that are cropping up and you want to find something that, is reliable, it gets to be pretty difficult. The stock market right now is really overvalued. PE ratios, as they say, price to earnings ratios are very high, meaning that people are paying a lot to buy these stocks, and hoping that the payout comes, you know, 20 years down the road. Gold is a safe haven. It's something that you can save in and bank on it not going to zero or not dropping, precipitously, you know, in the next few years.
Okay. So I definitely agree with all of that. Mm. And I think that's been certainly a message that we presented on the show in the past. In this context,
okay,
in the paper, there is a discussion about Cyprus. It's brief, maybe only one paragraph. And it talks about this concept of a bail-in. This happened there.
Yes.
Where they basically, the government basically looted the savings account of
it went into people's bank accounts and took out all money over 100,000 euros.
Good heavens. And I think a lot of people hear that and they say that would never happen here. But not that exact thing, but something like that did happen here once, and it happened with gold.
Right.
So then there's this question, and I'm, you know, it's not your responsibility to answer all of this, of course, but how do people protect against something like that, just in your opinion?
So you're referring to the Roosevelt.
Franklin Roosevelt, Great Depression.
President Roosevelt did issue executive orders to confiscate gold. In actuality, there were very few prosecutions. It's very difficult to collect gold. One of the advantages of gold and silver is you have it in your hand, like firearms and ammunition. It's with you. It's in your house. They're not going to go searching home to home. Hopefully, we never get to the point where the government troops are going to go home to home looking for your gold.
Right.
So you can have the value in your complete control, and that's a major advantage of gold. Under the gold confiscation, there were safety deposit boxes that they went after people's gold if you had it in a bank safe deposit box. Currently, if you look at the terms and conditions of bank safe deposit boxes, they tend to say, don't hold gold and silver here. We're not responsible.
Okay.
There are overseas vaulting options if people you don't want to have it in their home. But one of the main advantages of gold is it is somewhat immune to those kinds of measures. Unfortunately, I think if it weren't for government intervention, gold and silver, especially silver, would still circulate as money. So they have been able to make it illegal for people to trade effectively in a business context. If I have a business and I say I want to accept silver, I'm in a legal gray area right now. And, you know, they went after Bernard von Nothaus of the Liberty Dollar and said not only charged him with imitating the coinage of the United States, but also charged him simply with trading in silver. So there are some of those concerns. But as far as an investor, it's perfectly legal to buy gold and silver and hold it in your house. If that legal situation changes, you're fairly well protected as long as you don't go around flashing your stack of gold.
Right. So don't make rap videos with it.
Right.
Okay. Fair enough. That's good advice, Mike. You know, the other thing too, when we're talking about the early 1930s, I think it's fair to say it is a bit of a generalization, but it was a time when I think people by and large were more naive about their relationship with the government. And I think that people, you know, short, 85 years of lessons of people's relationships with governments. It might have been hard, whatever the government was able to take from people as far as gold was concerned, that probably wouldn't be the case today either. I have a hard time believing that the kind of people who have that attitude, that they're buying gold and silver, that they understand why that's a really sound decision, especially if they have a lot of wealth to protect, they're probably not the kind of people who would turn it over to the government. Generally.
Almost all of the gold that was surrendered, that was taken, quote unquote, in the 30s was surrendered voluntarily.
Yeah.
People said, well, it's against the law now. I'm a law-abiding citizen. And they went and turned in their gold.
Yeah.
I agree. I don't think that would happen today. I mean, one concern that has been brought up is gold and silver have had quite a run over the last 10 years. So people say, well, why isn't gold and silver in a bubble? One of the things you can look at is very few people know anything about it. That mania that you see with dot-coms, with housing, you know, even with people taking out tremendous amounts of student debt, you don't hear, there's not shows about people going and stacking their silver coins and gold coins. There's no mania around it. So the assets, you know, no one's going to perfectly know if the assets are appropriately valued, but you can't have some confidence that you're not in a bubble when everyone's not buzzing about the asset that you're looking at. And I think gold and silver, you know, the media is permanently against people investing in these metals. They just don't like it.
Do they have any justification for that? Like, is that ever explained why they don't like
it? There's a good reason to not put all of your wealth into gold
and silver. Of course, yeah, sure.
If you're expecting us to, the zombie apocalypse to be upon us, and you want, you know, to have something that is tradable, then maybe. But for, in general purposes, we're trying to avoid inflation. We're trying to have some security in our portfolios. You allocate, you know, 5 to 10% into precious metals. The rest, you want to have assets that have a return. If you invest in a business, it's also somewhat inflation resistant because they can continue to charge more and more. You know, McDonald's will just raise their prices as inflation continues. You also have a productive business. It yields returns. So gold and silver are equivalent to cash, where if you just hold cash, you don't expect to see an investment return. You expect it to hold its value. Unfortunately, we're entering a historical era where holding cash is very unlikely to keep its value. So then you turn to gold and silver.
Okay, understood. What would you like to say about Bitcoin, if anything?
I'm a big fan of Bitcoin.
Yeah.
I think it's wonderful new technology. I think it could potentially supplant gold and silver in a lot of ways. It is brand new. So I do think it's still in the speculative era of its development. Anything that's 5 years old, even if gold and silver were 5 years old, there would still be a lot of what we call an economics price discovery going on.
Yeah.
If you have masses of new people adopting something like Bitcoin, it's going to affect the price. If you have these new businesses like Mt. Gox coming into existence, it was a Bitcoin exchange that folded in Japan. The market is so small, there were only a few exchanges, that when one of them had a scandal, that dramatically affected the price. So if you're someone that's looking to do capital preservation, I want to know that I'm putting my money somewhere safe. I think Bitcoin is still in the speculative phase.
Yeah, I mean, if we were having this discussion definitely 2 years ago, I wouldn't have even brought it up. Because who knew? You know,
right.
I mean, $1, $1.50, $10, $21,
right.
$4.
Right.
It seems like over the course of the last, I would say, pretty solid year, it's been in a stable range or a stabilizing range.
Right.
Which is why I would enter it into this discussion. And of course, there are a lot of people don't know this, and it's something that I've been meaning to learn more about as well. There are ways of using Bitcoin without the internet through things like paper wallets. And, you know, like if there was some kind of collapse,
right,
there are still possibilities.
Well, you do need, someone needs to check the internet at some point to check the blockchain. But yeah, you can hypothetically trade the private keys as paper wallets.
Yes, if everybody's not walking around with it in their hand
right.
all day like we do now, but it still exists,
right.
there is still a way.
If there were any kind of major issue with the internet, Bitcoin would go down with
yep.
the internet and gold and silver would retake their place. Unfortunately, what I think one of the worst consequences of what Washington has done
mm-hmm.
is they have removed safety.
Yeah.
Even gold and silver, because they've been somewhat demonetized, meaning that governments have prevented them from circulating as money, there's fewer people that have them, so the price is more volatile. So it becomes hard even for investment professionals to say, okay, if you go into this asset, which they've been able to do for generations, they can say, if you buy U.S. treasuries, you have, by all accounts, you're going to be okay. You're going to get your coupon. You're going to be fine. There's not going to be a default or a massive inflation that's going to erode all the value of that bond. That's been true for most of U.S. history. That we've been this island of stability.
Yeah.
In some ways, we're returning to the mean. We're getting back to most of human history where safety was just a question of trade-offs. You know, if I do this, you know, that, you know, I might get eaten by the lion, but if I do this, I might, you know, if I don't go after the gazelle, I might starve to death. You know, we're going back to where you have to make these really difficult decisions and it's difficult for people. So I think Bitcoin, I consider it to be an asset, as far as an investment is concerned, it's a speculation. if you're buying Bitcoin hoping for it to, you basically, most people are hoping for it to go up. I think if you're buying Bitcoin expecting the price to stay stable over the next 10 years, you're likely to be very disappointed.
Mm-hmm.
Though that could mean that it goes up fantastically.
Yeah.
I just think that the Bitcoin is such a new technology. There's still so few people relatively using it, and it has such potential. I mean, just, if Bitcoin was this little niche thing and it had reached the top of its market, and what is going on with Bitcoin now is the be all and end all of Bitcoin, then maybe the price is stable for good. But, I think a lot of us who are following it are expecting Bitcoin to hopefully supplant national currencies. It might be the world's currency unit in a generation. If that's the case, then the price will go up substantially from where it is now. On the other hand, Bitcoin is reproducible. Unlike gold and silver, which are natural elements, Bitcoin, you can create another coin. There's probably a million altcoins now. People can issue their own coin. There's improvements that are going to be coming out. So we don't know for sure that Bitcoin is going to be the end state of the technology. I'm pretty fairly confident that blockchain technology will cause a big headache for national currencies, that
sure,
it's going to be more, a bigger and bigger part of our life. But is Bitcoin going to be that winner of that process? Well, in the early 2000s, everyone thought MySpace was here to stay, and it was the social network. And, News Corp bought them out at a huge valuation because MySpace was the place to be. And then, 2 years later, it was over. Technology allows for that. There's less of a moat, as they say. There's less people being stuck in a particular frame or way of doing business. So I think Bitcoin is still fairly speculative. I think gold and silver have a longer track record. That's not to say there's not volatility. I mean, you can look at the last 10 years and see that there is volatility in gold and silver. It goes up, it goes down. Silver especially is a response to industrial incentives. So if China right now is having a slowdown, that means they're buying less silver to use in electronics, in medical equipment, and so on. So your silver goes down. But if you want an asset that you control, that gives you financial privacy, you can keep it to yourself. It's not bits in a computer. It's not digits in an account. It has the value because of demand, and it's in your hand. That's the thing that you can only really get from precious metals.
Okay, so a variables question, a fun trivia question, and then we'll wrap up.
Okay.
Variables question. Is it believed that there is still, and I just have no idea what the answer is to this question, that there's still a lot of gold and or silver to mine?
There are stores of gold and silver to mine. No one really knows the total underground supply of gold and silver. There has been a fairly steady mining rate of about 2% a year for modern history.
2% growth of the total
gold supply.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay, a fun trivia question. I could have found this out by Googling it before we started, but do you know how much gold there is in the world?
No. I think it's a cube that fits inside an Olympic swimming pool.
That's what I heard too. That's why I asked.
That's conventional wisdom. It's not a lot. I think we would all be shocked if we stood in front of all the world's gold and in one lump.
Interesting. All right. So to wrap up today, and just to return to the student loan thing for a minute, you're a fairly young, successful guy. What advice would you give to kids who might be getting ready to sign, not their entire lives away, but definitely accept a huge burden for this opportunity to go to college 2015, 2016, somewhere around there? Or even if you want to add to that, kids who might have just started, they were freshmen this year, last year.
Don't consider it free money. Don't think, well, I'll deal with that at the tail end.
Yeah.
This is something that can follow you for the rest of your life. It's a big decision. There was a semi-informal survey done by a personal finance site where they asked young people, people my age, where the average student loan debt was $35,000 per person. They said, what would you do to cancel all your debt right now? 38% said they would partake in a questionable health study, basically being like a guinea pig for an FDA study. 32% said they'd sign up for active duty in the military. 30% said they'd sell an organ. Take very seriously how you're going to feel in your mid-20s when you've got the burden of all of this debt and you're thinking that the easy way out is to sell one of your organs. It is a serious decision. There are still people where college can make sense. If you're in the STEM field, science, technology, engineering, math, college courses can teach you a lot and open doors for you. If you're going to become a physician, if you're going into law, the law is its own bubble right now. So I don't recommend it. Don't just sign up with federal student loans to take out $100,000 in debt to go get yourself a philosophy degree. I got a philosophy degree, but I had a scholarship and I didn't walk away with debt. So I likely would not have done it if I had to take on debt. Just realize this is a very big decision, and it's a special kind of debt that leaves you in this weird quasi-legal indentured servitude for the rest of your 25 years. They can garnish your wages for 15%. You don't know what you're going to want to be doing. The opportunity cost of college is 4 years of your life that you could be out there forming your own business. I mean, think about it. Maybe someone's not handing you the same $100,000 to form your own business, but 4 years of experience going and forming a business plan, taking out a loan, saying, this is what I want to do, finding mentors, taking individual courses online. There's Coursera, there's Khan Academy.
Yep.
Listening to this podcast.
Yep.
Educating yourself. I think for most people, if you've got your wits about you, if you're, you know, if you don't want to just be some corporate exec punching papers, you're going to be better serving yourself, taking your education into your own hands, and not being saddled with this incredible amount of debt.
Awesome. Mike, thanks so much for coming on the show and for all this information. I really appreciate it. And tell people where they can learn more.
So if you want to learn more about the student loan bubble, if you go to shiffgold.com, that's shiffgold.com, you can download the white paper. There's a big banner right there. And there's plenty of other interesting reading along these lines at that website.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Everybody, before we wrap up today, just a few closing thoughts. In the near future, we probably actually will revisit this topic and take more of a historical approach to understanding this current situation of $1.2 trillion in student loan debt. And we approached the problem today, obviously, primarily through an economic lens. And I just want to shift focus a little bit here and talk about a few things that were on my mind going into this show that just didn't fit into our conversation. So yeah, it's hard to watch that video that Peter Schiff put out of all of these people with broken dreams. And obviously, it wasn't Peter Schiff's job to do it. But what I think would have been an interesting video is to drill down a couple layers. And, you know, ask all these people, like, well, why did you go to school for this thing you said you went to school for? And even a layer further, you know, how much trust did adults communicate to you, either your parents or your guidance counselors or your teachers or other authorities in your life, when you were going through the process of making that decision? What should I major in college, you know? Now, remember, I've talked about this on the show before. At one point in my career, I was doing a lot of college consulting, and years after that, when I was teaching those group SAT classes, I would always go around and ask everyone, why are you here taking the SAT? The only point of taking the SAT is for college admissions. So what do you want to do? Why do you want to go to college? And I was so frequently saddened and sometimes like frustrated by just this constant disconnection between passion and professional plans. One of the most common answers was, and I mean, not that these things aren't important, right? Like, no, when you're going to go to college with a certain major, yes, it's a good idea to know what the outlook is as far as job prospects, as far as industry growth for 5-6 years later. in an effort to protect your investment. Sure, I understand that. But to be one of the most common answers that I received, like, oh, I'm doing this because there'll be a lot of jobs, usually like healthcare majors, and I'm not talking about like medical school or becoming doctors, but just careers in healthcare. People saying there'll be a lot of jobs in healthcare. Yeah, of course there will. There'll be probably more jobs than there are now in healthcare. But that's how you're deciding what you want to do with the rest of your life. The security that somebody will continue to send you a paycheck for something you may or may not enjoy. And when I reflect back on that experience, I also, you know, I feel a lot of gratitude. And I'm not exactly sure what to attribute this to, other than luck or maybe some kind of a rebellious spirit that I had. But many key aspects of our personalities form at a very early age, followed by ideas. Maybe instead of ideas, you know, early on, they're more just like impulses about how to project those unique personalities we have out into the world through actions or activities or artistic expression. But first, you know, we project those unique personality traits out into the world through words and behaviors. Unfortunately, during that time where we're originally trying to be heard, most of us are stuck in places where we're told to sit still and be quiet. And I thought about that, you know, fast forwarding to 17, 18 years old, the kids I was working with, this recognition that so many people leave school, I don't want to say without any identity. I think that's way too harsh and way too general. But from my experience, there were a lot of people leaving secondary school with a serious disconnection between identity and vocation. And this was over and over and over again. I remember being excited when one of the responses from one of the students in this SAT class would be something like, I want to do this because I really love this. I'm really excited about this. But you'd be surprised. That was kind of rare. You think you go back and you listen to Obama speaking to students, you think there'd be a lot of idealism at that point in life when you're in the position that so many high school students are in, which is with very, very little information about the realities of this endeavor. Obama's little speech there, I don't think really helped. No one ever said anything about entrepreneurship. Ever. I would have remembered it. I would have written it down. I would have probably talked about it on the show through most of these classes that I was teaching. I was doing this show. It was all go to college, get a job. Now, as I think more about my professional goals, like really I'm thinking about it pretty intensely over the last month, and I know this is a cliche. I know this sounds like something a guidance counselor might say, but it's a worthwhile visualization. Thinking about where I am and thinking about my destination and picturing a roadmap, right? And if you look at a map of, you know, here you are, here's where you want to go, obviously you can see there's myriad ways to arrive in that destination. Some are faster, some are slower, some are straighter, some are more windy, but you have lots of options, you know, as long as you really understand clearly your ultimate destination, a vision, I guess. Well, no one ever showed us a map, you know, when 20 years ago when I was a senior in high school. And when I was working as a college consultant, like from roughly 2006 to 2008, and then doing these SAT classes from 2009 to like 2011, 2012, these kids weren't being shown maps either. They were being shown the on-ramp to a crowded highway called graduate from high school, go to college. So let's go back to these personalities forming at a very young age and ideas or impulses relating to how to project those personalities out into the world. And I'll just tell you my own experience. Some of it you know, but I'll put it in the context of this discussion. So we did this show earlier in the summer about the adverse childhood experiences, and I kind of revealed that I used to play baseball by myself as a lad, dress up in a uniform, and I think I kind of explained it as just really loving baseball. I love baseball so much I had to go out and make up teams and play games by myself. But a really important part of that, and this started when I was about 8 years old, was doing the announcing for the games, like the being the play-by-play guy who would talk about what's happening in the game. And then also being the color commentator, right? So play by play would be like, so and so steps up to the plate. Here's the pitch, ball one, just a bit outside. And then the color guy chimes in and he says, you know, Steve, Greg Perkins has really been terrific since coming back from that knee injury. And, you know, I was speaking to him in the clubhouse. He's usually kind of a folksy, the color guy, from what I found in baseball. But I would do both of these characters. And I love that. And in fact, by the time I was 12 years old, my dad found me this camp. It was, I think it was like in Concord, New Hampshire. It was called New England Sportscaster and Sports Writer Camp. And I went there for 3 years, 12 years old, 13 years old, 14 years old. And most of the kids at the camp were like 16, 17, 18, maybe even some college kids were there. And I started going when I was 12 because I was so passionate about getting into that world. That was what I wanted to do, I thought. But I only had enough experience to know that I wanted to put it into like baseball. And then I guess 4 years after the camp ended, I went to college to major in communications, study how to do television production, news writing. I was really into like newspaper layouts, like coming up with creative ways. I mean, there are rules you have to follow with a newspaper, with any type of publication, but buried in the back of my ambitiousness was this idea about film. Like, wouldn't that, but this was by the time I was like 18, 19, 20, maybe once I was already into college. But I was still working along the same ambition line, the entryway for which really appeared to me at a very, very young age. And I graduated with my shitty, worthless BS in communications. And I've talked about, you know, why it was worthless, because the entire industry changed while I was in school between 1995 and the year 2000. During that time, I did an internship with a filmmaker, a film production company outside of Boston. And then because of some of the experiences that I had in college, my career shifted into education. But even as I started to get these education jobs, I was the lead teacher at a special campus at this boarding school. I started a newspaper. I gave the kids jobs. I said, "These are, if you work for a newspaper, these are the things you could do." They all filled the jobs and we put out a school paper. I moved on to another job working for the same people at a day school. I ran like all the publications. I did video documentation of adventure trips. I interviewed kids. I recorded them playing music. I just kept doing these things that I liked to do, that I had wanted to do from a very young age. And just finding a way to fit it in, whatever I was doing. And I always talked about college being such a waste of time and money. Even though the truth is, I'm glad I went. I had some really valuable experiences. It's where I discovered my love of history. It's where I realized I was fairly capable as a thinker, which certainly was not something communicated to me in high school through grades or teacher feedback. But I remember when it occurred to me, like in the last couple of years, it's like, wow, what I'm doing today is actually very, very, very connected to goals I had. Or ideas I had, dreams I had, emotional needs I was trying to meet related to projecting my personality out into the world around me when I was like 7 or 8 years old. I'm glad my parents were supportive, like finding me camps, being patient with me as I kind of experimented with different things in school and supporting me in the early days of my career when I wasn't sure what I wanted to do, and I felt like I should have been using my degree, but none of that was necessary. I just really needed people to, first of all, talk to me about what was important to me as far as goals and visions were concerned, understand that achieving those things is not the on-ramp to a congested highway with very expensive tolls, if you will. It's a roadmap. And I wish that was a conversation that more authority figures in my life would have been able to have with me. And let's be clear. Am I doing the play-by-play or the color commentary for the Red Sox? No. And honestly, the truth is that today, with this broader perspective of the world, I think that would be pretty lame. I'm not saying it's a lame thing to do. I'm saying it would be a lame thing for me to do, knowing what I know, focusing where I focus, having accumulated the experience and knowledge that I have accumulated, it would kind of be a waste to be talking about baseball players. But when I think about the satisfaction that I got from doing that, or thinking about doing that, or going to this camp and writing like sports news packages, or doing play-by-play at some single-A baseball game, I experienced the same satisfaction doing what I do now. This is even cooler. There's less rules. I can do this however I want to do it, as long as, you know, I do it in a way where people want to support it financially, so it can be, you know, a career. And even that is something that's always in a process of being reworked. So, yeah, I got to express a little bit of gratitude here that I didn't, for whatever reason, even if it's just luck, I didn't lose sight of the way of expressing my personality, you know, professionally, that brought me happiness and satisfaction and a sense of accomplishment. So I hope that's one of the reasons why this show is useful. I mean, we can warn you about the economic implications of the student loan thing. We can hopefully educate people on the history. And like I said, we will do this eventually, about how this situation really came to be. Because there's a darker side to it that I didn't get into with Mike. And it's worth talking about in the future. But also why this whole crisis is really a symptom, I think, of a larger problem that has to do with how children are mistrusted, mistreated, ignored in our society, really, through the school system. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on all of this. I will post this show in the group. You can comment there. Go to schoolsucksproject.com and leave a comment right below the show notes for this episode. More stuff coming soon, everybody, and have a good week.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please help us out by leaving a positive review on iTunes. If you were angered by the show, please help us out by leaving negative reviews everywhere. If you think this is an important message for students, for parents, or for the future of intellectual freedom, please consider supporting us. SchoolSucksProject.com/AV. For $6 a month, you'll get access to hundreds of additional hours of content while helping us grow and spread this message further.